This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at numberfire.com, and this is episode 34 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the Number Fire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. On Tuesday's Late Round Pod episode that dropped, I gave you the 10 most underrated players in fantasy football drafts. And, spoiler alert, at number one was the dad running Frank Gore. I didn't hear much pushback for the pick, but some folks did hit me up on Twitter noting that they're not drafting Frank Gore because he's not a league-winning type player. He's not a guy who has enough upside to take over and win a championship for a fantasy football squad. At first, when I hear that, I think, yeah, man, that's totally valid. But then I'm like, what the hell is a league winner anyway? The phrase has been thrown around so much over the last couple of years, and I've always had a hard time with it. Maybe because I'm sometimes an idiot and dissect really worthless stuff in fantasy football, but maybe because it's a term that's kind of dumb. Like, intuitively, I know what league winner means. Josh Gordon, when he broke out, was a league winner. Devontae Freeman a couple of years ago, he was a league winner. But like, league winners don't grow on trees. They don't just happen all the time. There's a small chance, even just from a random probability standpoint, that you'll draft this year's one or two, quote, league winners. But there's an even smaller chance that you're missing out on said league winner by drafting Frank Gore in the seventh or eighth round of your fantasy football draft. Meaning, the opportunity cost in drafting Frank Gore shouldn't be considered I'm not getting a league winner, because the chance of you actually foregoing a league winner by choosing Frank Gore is very slim anyway. I get the overall notion, though, that you want players with upside in those middle and late rounds. I'm all about that life. It's why I ranted on and on during that same podcast about how I'd rather have Samaje Perine than Rob Kelly in fantasy football this year. But that doesn't make Frank Gore any more or less of a value in my opinion, especially because I think folks generally undersell Frank Gore's weekly upside. Like I said last week, he still had high-end RB2 top 12 performances last year, and he was an RB1 in terms of top 18 and 24 performances. Will he be a league winner? No, he won't be a league winner, whatever that means. We know what we're expecting. But knowing what we're expecting doesn't take away the fact that he's still a screaming bargain. And it also doesn't change the league winning opportunity cost side of things. As is with anything fantasy football related, Gore will be more beneficial on some rosters versus other rosters. If you need upside after going running back early, then don't draft Frank Gore. If you need a floor, Gore is as safe as they come, especially at that price. And that's what I want to get across most. There's complexity to this game if you want there to be complexity, which is why I'm not so totally in love with rankings in fantasy football in the first place. The game is not played linearly. Rankings tell you that it's played linearly, but it's not played that way. So when you hear answers to the mailbag questions on today's episode or other episodes, I just ask that you remember that. Very rarely does one answer fit every single situation in fantasy football. But that's also why we love it, right? Let's dig into this week's questions. This first one is from Ross Kidwell. It's an email. He says, thanks for the great, easy to digest content. I like the to the point nature of the podcast. Thanks, Ross. Who are your favorite round 15 plus MFL 10 running backs and wide receivers? While trying to diversify my ownership percentages on players, I've gone early quarterback and early tight end in a few drafts, and I find myself lost on who to pick in the later rounds in the wide receiver and running back positions. Thanks, Ross. Well, naturally, Ross, finding any sort of reliable round 15 plus players is going to be difficult because they're being drafted that low for a reason. As I like to say, though, sometimes with later round picks, you have to tell a story to see how these players could obtain a lot of upside in fantasy football. Maybe that story includes an injury, or maybe it's just that the player ahead of them on the depth chart just isn't as good as what the consensus thinks. But telling that story is a good way to see the path to upside. One player I like a lot, given this, is DeAndre Washington. I've talked him up on the show before, but Marshawn Lynch is 31 years old. He hasn't played football in a year and a half. And reports this week said that the Raiders might keep Marshawn Lynch to under 200 carries this year. While Jalen Richard is there and could easily end up stealing carries in that backfield, I like DeAndre Washington more given he got the edge in volume when Latavius Murray was out last year. And he has a better overall profile as a prospect in the NFL or an early down running back. I also think throwing darts at good offenses is a good idea too. Though I think Mike Gillisley will be the guy in New England this year, we know there's a chance that Rex Burkhead could become something too. It's not likely, but it's possible. So Burkhead is someone I'd target given he's in one of the best offenses in football. And I also kind of like Robert Turbin while everyone's into the rookie Marlon Mack. I think Mack might end up being more of a scat back at the NFL level, which makes Turbin the early down guy if Gore does indeed finally go down. That's not why I like Turbin though. That's not the sole reason. You know I don't like handcuffing. The handcuff thing is only a plus. Last season, while Gore was 18th in carries from within the opponent's 5-yard line, Turbin was actually next with just one fewer attempt. The Colts are going to score, giving both of those backs opportunities for touchdowns. So I don't mind Turbin as a dart throw because he might have some usable weeks in there. At wide receiver, just to name a few dudes, I think Devin Funchess or Curtis Samuel are interesting. Maybe Chris Conley, though I don't want to put a lot of stock into Alex Smith. Malcolm Mitchell, since he kind of serves as a handcuff in that New England offense, but also might have some usable weeks in there. And then my favorite lower key year one rookie wide receivers in Chad Williams and Kenny Golladay. I hope that helps. This next one's from Twitter at Seth Head. How high is too high on Terrell Pryor? Terrell Pryor's average draft position has gotten a lot higher than I ever imagined. When he first went to Washington, I talked about how he had top 10 upside at wide receiver, and I was met with, whoa, hold on a minute, top 10 wide receiver? And now he's being selected at wide receiver 14 when I thought his ADP would be around maybe wide receiver 20. With all that being said, I do think this is about it for Pryor. I mean that both in terms of where I feel comfortable enough depending on how my early rounds go in drafting him and where his ADP is going to finish up. Maybe he'll move ahead of Brandon Cooks and DeAndre Hopkins, and I actually have him ahead of both of those guys in my own rankings, but there's little chance he'll move into that Doug Baldwin, Dez Bryant, Amari Cooper tier, I would think at least. Like I've said before though, Terrell Pryor matches up well with Kirk Cousins, who was first in air yards per attempt in 2016 among relevant quarterbacks, while Pryor was 20th in air yards per catch out of 93 receivers with 50 or more targets last year. I think Pryor is good, and I think his fit in this offense is really intriguing with so many pieces gone. But I don't think he's a necessity anymore because we know his downside is there. He's only played 1 year at wide receiver in the NFL, he's on a new team, and he might not play as significant of a role as we think. And that's why I wouldn't want him as my wide receiver one in fantasy football. So drafting or not drafting Terrell Pryor is one of those instances where one size will not fit all. This next one's an email from Jeremy Markham. Hey JJ, I really enjoy your show and your in-depth analysis. I appreciate that it is so informative and succinct. I play in a 2-quarterback league and I'm picking third. Every year our league drafts quarterbacks very aggressively with about 16 quarterbacks gone by round 3. I'm considering doing a late round QB and zero RB strategy and going wide receiver heavy with my first 3 or 4 picks. I already know the first guy is going to take Aaron Rodgers, and I believe the second guy will take Tom Brady, so that leaves me with taking possibly Drew Brees, or I could go Antonio Brown or David Johnson. I feel like I could land AJ Green with my next pick. Is this crazy to do in a 2-quarterback league, especially since quarterbacks are so aggressively taken? I'm also thinking of taking Brees and then going wide receiver heavy. Thanks for reading, Jeremy. So Jeremy, I think the podcast on understanding your league settings should help with this question a bit. So if you haven't listened to that, try it out. With that being said, no, you do not need to reach for a quarterback in this instance. I say reach because that's what you'd be doing. While you have to be cognizant of the fact that many quarterbacks are going to be off the board early and you can't wait forever because there is a supply of usable quarterbacks that will run out, it's important to remember that there are still a lot of usable quarterbacks in the NFL and in fantasy football. If this is a 10 or 12 team league, that means your league is starting 20 to 24 quarterbacks each week. For reference, that lower end QB will look like Alex Smith, Sam Bradford, or Joe Flacco. Meanwhile, the difference between a Breeze type player and those quarterbacks just isn't the same as what you'd get from David Johnson and a lower tiered running back. This isn't just based on value-based drafting either. I hate value-based drafting, which I've also podcasted about. This is based on the fact too that quarterbacks are predictable in fantasy football. And hey, that's another podcast that I did. I'm sorry, it's probably annoying that I always reference old podcasts, but the goal with all of the evergreen episodes that I've done is to have them as a backbone for arguments I'm trying to make so that I can reference them without having to go through the same information over and over again. Basically, what I'm saying with this, though, is that in a 2-quarterback league, while quarterbacks are certainly more important, you can still use the notion of predictability to help evaluate the position as a whole a lot stronger. You can get 3 middle-of-the-road quarterbacks, for instance, like Carson Palmer, Ryan Tannehill, and I don't know, Blake Bortles, and play them by matchup each week since the position is, again, very predictable. And while you're not going to match the production a team with Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady will have at the quarterback position, where you're actually winning is at running back and wide receiver, two positions that are tougher to predict and two positions that still hold the same demand in your league as you're starting two or three of them just as you're starting two quarterbacks. This is an incredibly, incredibly common question that I get with two quarterback leagues. People see the demand of the position double, so they freak out a bit. But the demand for running backs and wide receivers is still strong. Yes, you should draft your quarterbacks earlier in a two quarterback league. That's especially true when your league mates inevitably overvalue the position. But you also gain a significant edge at running back and wide receiver while your league mates reach for quarterbacks. My advice on how to tackle a draft like this then is to make sure you're able to get three of those mid to low tier QB2 types, which may start as early as, say, round 5, but pound running back and wide receiver in the earlier rounds before then. This next one's from Twitter, at Cameron9_Webb. Why not Bortles as a late-round QB if you miss on the Dalton/Rivers tier? You know, someone else asked about Bortles too. I know that Bortles' cumulative numbers have been good over the last 2 years, but my fear with him is kind of twofold. First, we know that he's not very good. He's been one of the worst quarterbacks in football since he entered the league, according to NumberFire metrics. Don't let his 2015 season fool you. It was the classic case of fantasy football not matching to the real game. Usually with quarterbacks, you want positive game scripts, but Bortles has been placed in such negative game scripts so often that he actually is a garbage time hero. In 2015, Bortles threw 280 passes when his team was trailing by 6 or more points, which was the third most in football. He also threw 20 of his touchdowns when seeing that type of point margin. 20! That's 3 more than any other quarterback in the league, and only 6 other quarterbacks had more than 10 touchdowns thrown while trailing by 6 or more points in 2015. Last year, Bortles topped the league in attempts while trailing by 6 or more, throwing 15 touchdowns. His touchdown rate when trailing by this margin in 2015 was 7.14%, which is absurd. And in 2016, it was 4.67%, which is also probably higher than it should be, but maybe not as absurd. Meanwhile, when Bortles was either within 6 points or leading the game last year, he naturally did not throw a ton of passes because the Jaguars weren't very good, but he had a 3.3% touchdown rate, and that was a little over 4% in 2015. Those numbers aren't very good. Blake Bortles has truly been the king of garbage time. So when you look at his potential in 2017, I don't know how you can get all that excited when you figure the Jacksonville defense is not that bad on paper at all, and they should be able to outperform where they've been the last 2 years, and then they drafted Leonard Fournette in an attempt to run the ball more. That means that there could be fewer ultra-negative game scripts for Bortles or fewer garbage time plays, which means fewer fantasy points altogether. I don't really think he's close to Andy Dalton from an upside standpoint this season. I think people are far too optimistic about a player who could be in more of a run-heavy offense, who's made a name for himself during parts of the game that just don't matter. This next one's an email from Joel. He says, JJ, longtime listener of Living the Stream, big time fan of all your content. Your advice in 2015 and 2016 netted me my first two titles. I'm a huge fan of this new podcast you're doing and love all the math-based analytics. Thanks, Joel. The Chris Harris podcast has convinced me that yards per carry is a terrible stat for running back. However, the majority of the fantasy football community seems to think that it is the best benchmark for running backs. I wanted to know your stance on yards per carry and if you also thought it was bogus. What is your go-to running back measurable? Secondly, is there an option for us diehard fans to purchase your prediction model results? After your pod about building a model, I thought about it, but I just don't have the time. All these sites do a draft kit and ask you to pay for it. I've considered it for a long time, but I feel like if I'm going to buy one, I'd like my money to go to my favorite analyst. Thanks again, Joel N. First off, Joel, thank you so much for the kind words. Regarding my model, I don't have my projections out there, but you can get NumberFire's projections for free on NumberFire.com. I think that's a really, really good starting point. I do have my rankings for premium users on there now too, despite the fact that I don't really like rankings in fantasy football. Have I mentioned that before? As for the yards per carry question, I don't know if the fantasy football community thinks that it's a really good statistic. I just don't think people have access to other ways of determining a running back's worth. I don't love yards per carry for fantasy football for two main reasons. First, naturally, big runs can skew the data. It's no different than looking at average fantasy points scored across a season. Big weeks can make a player look a lot better than he actually is. But second, and I think most importantly, efficiency isn't as big of a deal for fantasy football as we sometimes make it out to be. Volume drives fantasy football. If you don't have volume, you don't have anything. If you have efficiency with no volume, it does not matter. But if you have volume with bad efficiency, that player can still be fantasy relevant. So from that perspective, yards per carry isn't a huge deal, especially if you're looking at one player to the next and only seeing, say, a half yard carry in difference. Like, let's imagine player A sees 200 carries for 3.5 yards per carry in one season, while player B sees 200 carries for 4.5 yards per carry. Player A would gain 700 yards, while player B would net 900 yards. That's a 200-yard difference, but that's still just 20 fantasy points across an entire season. That's not amazingly significant. You need touchdowns, receptions, and receiving yards to really be a complete back from a fantasy football perspective. I do think it's an interesting exercise, though, to look at yards per carry or some form of efficiency metric and compare it versus teammates. Teammates are in similar situations. They're behind the same offensive lines, they have the same quarterback, and so on. So you get more of an apples-to-apples comparison among running backs. And when you see the difference in yards per carry from one teammate to the next, you can sort of see who outperformed what they were expected to do. Ty Montgomery and Bilal Powell were two guys who did that last year, just for the record. But how I measure running back success is to use some sort of efficiency metric, whether it's yards per carry or rushing net expected points per rush, and combine it with success rate or the percentage of positive expected point runs a running back gets per rush. Basically, success rate, as I've mentioned before, it's a binary way of looking at things. If a running back increases his team's expected point value, that run is deemed a success. If not, it's a failure. So if a player has a high success rate and low efficiency, it means he was just grinding out his runs, like Jaquizz Rodgers last year. If a guy has a low success rate and high efficiency, that's a red flag. That's when regression comes into play. That's when you get Todd Gurley in 2015 turning into a bust in 2016. So overall, no, I don't like yards per carry as a standalone statistic. Volume drives everything, and coaches are the ones deciding who sees that volume. They're not really looking at yards per carry to determine that either. But if a running back is good, he'll generally have the combination of a high yards per carry or high efficiency and a strong success rate. This next one's from Twitter, at DannyHall11. How do Watson, Trubisky, and Mahomes compare to guys like Mariota and Winston or Goff and Wentz for dynasty purposes? From a prospecting standpoint, I don't know how you can put Mariota and Winston in a tier with any of those guys. But I do want to mention that I did a basic study, one that I really do want to refresh because it's a little bit old, on how quarterbacks who started their careers poorly rarely turn things around. The only instances where a quarterback was bad to start their career and then got things going over the last decade and a half was basically Drew Brees and Alex Smith, and both of them needed location changes to do so. And Alex Smith is still kind of meh. Derek Carr is looking like an outlier from that perspective too, because his rookie season efficiency numbers weren't very strong. I mention this because Carson Wentz and Jared Goff were both pretty putrid according to NumberFire's expected points model last year, and as a result, I'm not burying them totally, but probability says that their careers may not look as strong as some might hope. As for the guys this year, quarterback prospecting is just incredibly difficult to begin with. I tend to side with Mahomes, but I'm certainly not overly high on any of them. This next one's an email from Jeff Smith. He says, "Hi, JJ. My question is about auction drafts. I've been in a 10-team league for 3 years doing an auction draft, but this year we're expanding to 12 teams. How will this impact the auction values? Will basically everyone be more expensive this year, or just the top-tier players? Is there a spot where draft values tend to occur in larger leagues? Overall, I'm just wondering how league size affects auction prices. Thanks for your insight, Jeff." I tend to think of auction drafts like an economy. Let's say you have a $200 budget, so in a 10-team league, there's $2,000 to be spent. Increase that by two teams, and you've got $2,400 to spend. As a result, with more teams, there's more money that can be thrown around, which increases the prices for players. That makes sense intuitively too, because with more teams, you know that your squads are going to look worse on paper, which means it's harder to obtain those assets. So you should expect all typical early and mid-round guys to be more expensive than usual. When it comes to the late round ones, still spend just a dollar or two on those dart throws. The difference between one from the other is very small when talking about later round players, so it shouldn't actually show up within their price tags. This next one's an email from Matt Rice. He says, "Hey JJ, was wondering if you could expand on some things you mentioned today or the day that he sent this email on the pod, specifically about regression analysis and especially when taking injuries into account. Here are the other players I'm curious about: Allen Robinson, Todd Gurley, Sammy Watkins, CJ Anderson, Amir Abdullah, and Keenan Allen. How can we best determine the difference between regression candidates and bounce back players when it comes to injuries? Thanks, Matt." Just so we're clear, or that I'm clear, regression really doesn't have to do with injuries unless it's clear that a player underperformed due to an injury. Maybe a good example of this is John Brown, who I mentioned on Tuesday's show that Brown had a very similar air yards per catch rate from 2015 to 2016, but his yards after the catch per catch dropped a lot from 2015 to 16. That told me that drop might have been due to his sickle cell trait, because that's a significant thing that changed from 1 year to the next. He was injured in 2016 and he was not injured in 2015. Regression that doesn't have to do with injury is just based on events that should have happened versus events that didn't happen. For instance, if a player sees a lot of yardage, you generally expect them to score a decent amount of touchdowns. It's like if you're going to play hours and hours of Overwatch as Hanzo, you better be a pretty freaking good Hanzo. But you probably won't, because Hanzo sucks. If that analogy blew over your head, don't worry, you're just not nerdy enough. Players who get yards score touchdowns. Of course, some guys are goal line backs or some players are red zone threats, but when you're looking at things as a whole from a high level, you don't need to recognize those individual players until after the regression analysis. Like when I chart net expected points from wide receivers versus touchdowns scored, I'm looking at the number of actual real expected points these guys tallied versus how many touchdowns they scored. Since touchdowns are somewhat random, I'm trying to see how many touchdowns they should have scored versus how many they did score. After doing that exercise, players like Davante Adams and Jordy Nelson show up at the top of the should have scored fewer list, while Terrell Pryor is on the should have scored more list. But it's obvious that Adams and Nelson are going to score more touchdowns given they're getting passes from Aaron Rodgers, while Terrell Pryor won't because he's got hot garbage throwing him the ball at quarterback. You do these analyses, though, to see where some underlying anomalies are occurring. And then you add context on top of it, so you're not just looking at what math says, but you're putting logic around why the math is saying what it's saying. And sometimes, like the John Brown instance, it is because of injury. This next one is from Twitter, at MattyMattE. He says, Adam Thielen finished 2016 as wide receiver 30 and is currently being drafted in the 11th round. Is he close to your top 13 underrated? If not, why? So Thielen may have finished as wide receiver 30 last year, but he also had just 3 weeks where he ranked higher than wide receiver 27 in PPR formats. You also had an injured Stephon Diggs last year, which upped Thielen's overall usage a bit, and one of those higher upside games that he had actually happened when Diggs was sidelined. I don't mind Adam Thielen at all, but that's why his ADP is where it's at. He wasn't a consistent week-in, week-out player, and his market share may not be as favorable with Stephon Diggs back and healthy. He's also going before Kenny Britt on fantasyfootballcalculator.com, so that's another reason I couldn't really pull the trigger on him. This next one, and I'm 1,000,000% going to butcher the name, is from Zon Patorgas. He says, in a 14-team PPR keeper, quarterback, running back, wide receiver, tight end, and flex, I am starting with Melvin Gordon, Jordy Nelson, and Martavis Bryant as keepers, and the top players available for my pick will likely be Amari Cooper, Doug Baldwin, DeAndre Hopkins, Demaryius Thomas, Todd Gurley, Lamar Miller, and any quarterback or tight end not named Gronk. Really don't like any of them. Who do you go with? Cooper and Baldwin, universally the favorites, are, for the reasons below, terrible picks, IMO. He then lists Amari Cooper and Doug Baldwin in PPR in 2016 and where they finished. He says the average weekly finish for Amari Cooper was wide receiver 36 with a median finish of wide receiver 42. Baldwin had a wide receiver 32 average weekly finish with a median weekly finish of wide receiver 28. And both of them had 24-point standard deviations, or this is what he says. And then Zon says, thanks. So I wanted to answer this one on the mailbag show because of the logic used when saying Baldwin and Cooper are terrible picks. It's often easy to look at descriptive data or how these players performed and draw conclusions. I do it all the time in describing how these players did. But we also have to remember that things change all the time from 1 year to the next. Just like you guys listening to the show keep getting more gray hairs each year as you age, these players are getting better or worse each season too. Moreover, I want to add the fact that you have to remember to put context to that descriptive data. When you're looking at how a player performed weekly, he naturally isn't going to have a median or average rank that's, say, something like wide receiver 5, because doing that consistently would mean that he's a legitimate unicorn. I just wanted to throw that out there. It's true, though, that Amari Cooper and Doug Baldwin are both inconsistent wide receiving assets, or they have been for fantasy owners. If that's not your thing, then stay away from them. I get it. But of the players that you mentioned, I would definitely go with one of those two. Specifically, I would go with Cooper because I think his lack of touchdowns is fixable given his age and the fact that the Raiders just need to make a more conscious effort in getting him the rock closer to the goal line. The dude is only 23 years old. He was still very usable in fantasy last year despite scoring zero red zone touchdowns. I wouldn't be shocked if this time next year, given the general progression for wide receivers, if Amari Cooper is a first-round draft pick in redraft leagues. But either of them are fine, in my opinion, especially since you have Jordy Nelson and Martavis Bryant. I'd then try to just balance things out a bit for more of a weekly floor with maybe a wide receiver like Jamison Crowder. The last question comes from my friend Rumford Johnny at Rumford Johnny. He says, talk me out of Eric as the final rose or confirm my take. Yes, everyone, this is a Bachelorette question. I like The Bachelor and Bachelorette because it's actually really, really good television. But Rummy, there's no way that Eric is the final rose. You can see it in her eyes. You can see they don't have the same chemistry as Brian and Peter. And I think Rachel is going to have some issues with the fact that Eric doesn't have relationship experience. That's going to be his demise. Eric is like Terrell Pryor, man. I can understand the upside that you're seeing, but he's also got that scary floor because of that inexperience. I unfortunately think that she's going to pick Brian, but I think that Peter is the one who's right for her. That'll do it for me though, guys. Thanks for listening to this week's show. If you could please, 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 I beg you, go to iTunes and give the Late Round Podcast a rating and review. It would be greatly, greatly appreciated. And subscribe to the show on there or on Stitcher or on SoundCloud or on Google Play or pretty much anywhere podcasts can be found. That way, you'll never miss another show. Enjoy your weekend, everyone.